I like that last clap. Whoever gave me that one, I appreciate it. My name is Don Maloney, and I am an alcoholic. And through the grace of God and people like you, I have not found it necessary to have a drink now since July 1st of 75, and for that I really am grateful. And it's good to be here, good to be sober, good to be anywhere, but especially sober and standing upright. You know, I always believe that there are no mistakes, and we're supposed to be right where we are when we are there, and so if you're wondering why you're here, you're on time. I just want to let you know that. Everybody go ahead and look at their watches now, because that means we know that 1 hour from now, if I'm not done, y'all can go ahead and leave. You know, that's just, you know, otherwise we spend half our time during the meeting going, I wonder if he's going to get through on time. I wonder if he's going to get through. Because I think our mind, our consciousness, and the bottom of our seat wears out in 1 hour, you know. And so we'll try to finish on time, get you all to that dance. You know, that's where the real activity goes on in Alcoholics Anonymous, at those AA dances. I want to thank the committee and Dave and everybody that was responsible for putting this on. Y'all are 212 people short of being the same size town that I come from, you know. And but my home group is the Lake Whitney group, and it is the AA capital of the world, where humility is our primary purpose. And we do have a sign in the clubhouse that says AA capital of the world, and my sponsor was Bob White. Some of y'all may have heard of Bob White, but old Bob, he's been dead now for quite some years, but he used to tell me, he said, son, he said, if you are ever asked to speak out of your own home group and allowed to go outside of the county again, he said, if you're ever asked to go outside of your home group and talk, he said, you must tell them two things. First of all, you must wear a coat and tie. He said, even though you don't look very dressed up today, he said, you have to at least look like you're sober, you know. And he said, so we want you, number one, to wear a coat and tie. And number two, you must tell them that you are from the AA capital of the world. And he said, and if you don't do that, you will be struck drunk within 24 hours. Yeah. And he's been dead a long time, but I'll still tell you where I'm from, and I'll still wear that coat and tie. And for those that I sponsor, you know what they do, don't you? Same thing. That's the way we get to do it. We get to pass it on. We really do. But it's been great being here. It really has been. The last time I spent the night, now I've been down here and I've been up to Blackstone and up to Blue Ridge and some other places, and some of y'all may have heard me talk, and some of y'all could care whoever's talking, you know. I mean, you know. But the real reality is the last time I spent the night in North Carolina was in 1960. And it was in a town called Valdez, North Carolina. Is anybody from Valdez in this room? Right there.
I know where it is.
You know where it is. Okay. I guess that counts, don't it? And I was stationed in the Navy up in New Jersey, and a friend of mine named Charles Pfeiffer Abernathy III. And if he's out here, raise your hand, Pete. I ain't seen you in years, but by God, we got drunk a lot together. And we were sitting there one Friday night, and he said, let's go home. I said, where's home? He said, Valdez, North Carolina. I said, all right. And we just saddled up that old Oldsmobile and took off and went down there, and it's a dry town. Which you know, if it's a dry town, that means there's more whiskey and white lightning in that town than any other town in the world. And we used to drink at a place called Crow Peak and Flat Gap and Crow Hill. Now, I'm not sure where any of those were, but when it got dark in that town, he said, come on, we're going up on the mountain. And I said, where is that? He said, up on the mountain, you know. And we went up on the mountain, and they had the daggondest juke joint up there you ever seen in your life. They had dancing and gambling going on, and liquor was going on. And that was the last time that I ever spent the night in North Carolina, you know. And to have, and I'm sure the statute of limitations has run out since then. I remember Pete left early that night and left me up there with all y'all, you know. And when it come time to close, you didn't know what to do with me one more time, you know. But I'll never forget that experience. And in fact, old Pete called me about, I guess I was married I was pretty, maybe sober or not quite sober, I don't remember, but he called me one night drunk on the phone, and he said, Maloney? I said, yeah, Pete. And I said, where have you been? I haven't talked to you for years. He said, I just joined the Navy, and I signed you up to go in with me. And I said, Pete, I'm married and got a couple kids. He said, oh, leave them. He said, they've all left me, you know. He said, I'm sitting here in this red chair, and he said, that's all I got left. And he said, I'm supposed to report for duty on Monday, and it's Friday. I'm coming to get you, you know. And I haven't seen Pete since that day, you know. But I know because he hung out with me that he belongs to be with you all, you know, because those are the kind of people that I hung out with, you know, and didn't know that for a lot of years. But so if you're here and you're wondering why you're here, stay here, because there's no other place to go. And I know that. I've tried it, and it just there's just no other place to go out there, you know. There really is. I've always enjoyed the fellowship that we have, and I think this fellowship here is probably one of the biggest rooms of fellowship that I've been in a long time, and I hope you enjoy being part of the fellowship. A friend of mine one time said that this person was not in Alcoholics Anonymous, and they were very church folks, and she said, I'm really fascinated with your all's fellowship. You know, and I said, well, it's pretty neat. It's a pretty neat deal, you know. And I said, we really do experience loving each other. And she said, I think I've got your all's fellowship figured out. And I thought that was strange because not many people can figure out what we're about, you know. And I said, what is it? And she said, it's all the fellows in the ship going in one direction. And I said, you're right. You're right. That's it. You know, she had never been to a business meeting. I could tell her that. A lot of people in here in service this weekend, and I think that's great. I think that's where you need to be, and you need to be involved in service. And I was in service when I was new in the program. And I went to my first service meeting, and I was GSR for my little group in Dallas, and where I was hanging out at the Alpha Club in Dallas, Texas. And went over to Fort Worth, and there were 300 or 400 people there. And they all got up and told who they were, and they'd give their name and their area and their title, and they'd go with about 4 or 5 initials on the end and all that sort of stuff. And I couldn't wait to get up and tell them that I was the GSR and what area I was from. And I was preparing my speech, and I thought, my God, I'm going to forget what numbers I'm supposed to say. You know, and they're going to find out, and they're going to kick me out of here. And there was an old guy named Homer Ramsey, and I can give you his name today because he's dead and died successful, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And Homer was sitting right next to me, and Homer just kept patting me. You know, that's what them old-timers do with them new guys. They just pat them a little bit, you know, and... And Homer had been served on every service board, I guess there was in that part of the country. And Homer stood up and he said, my name's Homer Ramsey. And he said, and the highest office you can hold in Alcoholics Anonymous is sober. And he sat down, you know. And nobody said anything the rest of the meeting, you know. But I think it's good to be involved in service community. I really do. It's good to be involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and in Al-Anon if you're in the Al-Anon family group, Al-Ateen, Al-Tot, Al-Dog. You know, it doesn't make any difference. If it's got a couple A's in it, join it, you know. Cause, you know. For a while there, we got carried away with all the ANDA diseases. We had them for a long time. There was, you know, it seemed like every time we turned around, there was a new ANDA disease, you know. I'm an alcoholic, ANDA, you know. I don't know if that happened down this part of the country or not. And I started one up in my part of the area because I like being new and starting things, and I was the adult husband of an Al-Anon, you know. And A-H-O-A. We didn't get any sympathy in our group. But I do want to introduce you to Precious. Precious, stand up. This is my Precious Al-Anon, Karen. Precious is here. Give her a hand. Yes, ma'am. I tell you, I'm in love with that lady. You know, I tell you, we have the best relationship. I bet probably better than most all y'all, you know. And the reason I know that, because it seems like it's working for me, you know. And I had trouble. I didn't have any trouble getting married, but I had trouble staying married for a while. Last time I was getting ready to get married, my sponsor, Bob White, said, we know that you know how to get married. We've watched you do it 2 or 3 times, you know. He said, what do you think, you're going to try to stay married this time? I said, well, yeah, you know. He said, well, then you need to start acting like it. I didn't like that, you know. I said, well, it sort of implied that I wasn't acting like I wanted to stay married before. And the problem I had was that I used to take hostages in my relationships, you know. I don't know if y'all ever done that, I'm sure, but, you know. But when you get one that's a black belt Al-Anon, you can't go around saying, that's my Al-Anon, I'll tell you that. You barely can say, it's my wife, you know. Thank God I own nothing today, you know. But it wasn't always that smooth, you know. Because life brings you sort of trials and tribulations and stuff you got to work through. And I'm just now, we will have 17 years of continuous marriage, you know, in about a week. August 15th, 17 years ago, I gave her me for her birthday, you know. 200 pounds of pure darling, you know. And we've stayed married all this time. After we were married a year, I thought, I've made a mistake. I said, she's not doing right, you know. And I went to Bob White's office, and she knew I was on my way down there because she sentenced me to go down there, sort of. I think they had pre-worked this deal out, and I went on down to Bob's office, and I said, Bob, I think I've made a bad mistake. And he used to call me Sugar Boy. And he said, well, Sugar Boy, he said, what is it you think you've made a mistake about? And I said, Bob, I'm one of those guys that should have never gotten married again. You know, we don't agree on anything. I mean, there's nothing that we agree on. Nothing. And of course, you know, when you're into it, you're into it. It's like nothing ever happened. Nothing was good. I mean, we can focus on the negative so quick and get it so big that it never worked. You know, never had one happy minute in our life. Of course, that's not true. But it is true the day you feel that way. It really is. And I said, we just are different. I said, we can't agree on anything. He said, I told you you had to be willing to go to any lengths to stay married. And I said, I'm willing to do that, Bob. He said, are you really? I said, yeah, I really am. He said, I've got the solution for you. He said, if you want to stay married, he said, I can tell you how to do it. And I thought, my God, you know. And I said, well, how do I do that? He said, start making the bed together every morning. And I thought, you old man, you ain't heard a word I've been talking to. I mean, sponsors are like that. They never give you straight answers about nothing. They don't. I said, do what? He said, I want you all to start making the bed together. I said, I don't do beds. He said, you're going to start making the bed together. I said, what's that going to do? He said, it's not about what it's going to do. It's what you're going to do. You're going to go home and you're going to start making the bed together every morning. So I walked in the house and she was standing there in that Al-Anon stance. She had them arms. Had one leg. I don't know how you women do it, but you got one leg and they cock it up on the other one, you know. I mean, sort of like a sobriety test, you know. And she said to me, what did he say? What did he say? And I said, you ain't going to believe what he said. I will. Tell me what he said. I said, he said we're going to have to start making the bed together. She said, oh, you liar. I said, no, I swear to God. She said, I don't believe a word you said, you know. She told me that if the alcoholic's lips are moving, he's lying, you know. And I picked up the phone. I called Bob. And I said, Bob, talk to her. And he said, Precious, what do you want? She said, Bob, what'd you tell him? He said, I told him you need to start making the bed together. She said, really? I said, yeah. Well, I'm going to tell you, when you don't get along doing anything and can't agree on anything, making the bed is not a real easy task. It's tough. We get in there and we turn them sheets. I can't tell you the number of couples we sponsor work with, and you know what we tell them, don't you? We see them traveling around the world and they say, we're still doing the bed. One sheet at a time, you know. About 2 weeks into this bed-making deal, I thought, I don't have to do this. I'm a grown man. This is child stuff. Why do I listen to that old man anyway? He doesn't look he's that happy. He may be married, but he doesn't look that happy to me. I come walking out of the bathroom, and she said, honey, we have to make the bed. I said, I'm not making the bed this morning. She said, "What?" I said, "I am not making the bed this morning." She said, "Bob said you had to." I said, "I don't care what that old man said. I'm not making the bed." And I hit the door, and she was hot on my breath, and she yelled at me, said, "You'll have the worst day of your life." You know. And it absolutely was the worst day I've ever had in sobriety. Now, I don't know why that works, but I will tell you that even when we travel, if we start to arguing or debating, we call it debating, you know, when we start debating when we're on the road, you know what we'll do? Even if we're in a hotel, we'll make the bed. It confuses the maid, I'll tell you. Not many of them speak English, but when they walk in there and can't figure out if they've been there or not, you know. So if you're having trouble with your marriage, there's the key. Just do that. And make a lot of meetings. That helps too. And work the steps and talk to your sponsor and trust in God, you know. And we've had a good marriage. We really have. And Karen never had the opportunity to see me drinking, you know. And she says she's very grateful for that, you know. A friend of mine that we all know in AA got drunk on is not too long ago and lost about 20 years. And my sponsor, Jerry J. in Dallas, Texas, was talking to his wife, Billy, and he was really distraught over this particular deal. And he said, "God, I can't believe a guy when I got drunk after all these years, you know." And he said to Billy, he said, "Billy, if I ever drank again," he said, "would you still love me?" She said, "I'd love you, Jerry, but I'd miss you, you know." And believe you me, my black belt down on, she'd miss me. She said, "I've heard your story. I don't want no part of you when you was drinking, you know." You know, there are, you never know when you're going to have an impact on somebody's life, and usually you don't know because you don't know. And it's only when you think you're going to impact somebody's life that you don't have any effect at all, you know. And that's been my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And Dave asked me to come over here and talk and some months ago and sent me a letter, and it was a nice letter, and we were really excited about coming over to this part of the country and talking. And my wife says that she doesn't have a clue as to how I have anybody that I sponsor. She said, "You treat them mean, you know." I said, "No, I don't treat them mean." I said, "I just sort of hand out what was handed out to me, and that's the only way I know to give it away." And she said, "Yeah, but you make them do stuff." And I said, "Well, yeah, but they made me do stuff, you know." I guess the purpose of that is that I received a letter from another guy, and this was not a member of the committee. And one of the things that I do in my group is that if I'm going to work with you, we don't do a couple of things. We don't do anything that's going to keep us apart from the rest of us. Because when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I have to tell you that I bounced in out of AA for a couple years, you know, and the reason I did is I had another illness, and it was called terminal uniqueness. You know, some of y'all may be suffering tonight from that, you know. I'm not quite like those people, you know. And if you looked at me in those days, I didn't look quite like you all did, you know. I mean, I just didn't have my hair quite right, my clothes quite right, and I went to a point to not look like you people, you know. And so I have learned in Alcoholics Anonymous that whatever separates me from you also separates me from God. And therefore, I have to become a part of who you are. And so, therefore, when I sponsor them and they come in with them long ponytails and them earrings, we start collecting them, is what we do, yeah. I got me a couple of what I call hit babies, you know, them are them big old guys. And they walk around with shears and scissors and go, "I'm only sponsoring you, scoop," you know. And the only reason I do that is because it separates them from me and me from you. And eventually it will separate you right out of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous if you hold on to your terminal uniqueness. And the reason why it does that is because we, for the first time in our life, are the most disorganized, disorderly, rebellious people in the world. And we operate so well within the structure of Alcoholics Anonymous that you might as well give up, because your life's going to get better if you do. In order to do that, you have to be a part of. Well, I sort of have that redneck reputation, I guess, and that's okay. It really is okay, because they had to clean me up in order to get me to be a part of who you were. And I got a letter from this old boy, and I'm going to read it to you. And I met this guy 6 years ago at a conference somewhere over here, you know. And it said, Don said, now I live in Evanston, Illinois. Dave Cook tells me every time he speaks with you that he asks you if I've cut my hair yet. Said, the last time I spoke with Dave, he said he told you that I had cut my hair. I figured I'd send you some proof. I look forward to seeing you in August when you're in Raleigh. And in the mail, I got his ponytail. Greg, stand up and show him how you've cleaned up your act. Where's Greg at? Hey! Karen said, I can't believe somebody mailed you their ponytail. You know. Greg's in graduate school and going to be a professor here in this year or two. Isn't that scary? God, I tell you. So you never know when you're going to be involved in somebody else's life, and that's part of what we're here about, because it says in my book and in my program that our primary purpose is to be of maximum service to who? God and our fellow man, you know. And that's really what it's about. It isn't about houses and cars and boats and planes and diamond rings and your wife and my wife and all that other stuff that goes on in what I call regular old life. But I will tell you, it's about my relationships with you people. And it's taken me this long to really sort of understand that completeness of how important that relationship is for me to have a relationship with you all, you know. And because I was the kind of guy that got to Alcoholics Anonymous and I didn't want to relate to nobody, you know, just leave me alone. I mean, you know, I never hurt anybody when I drank, by God, leave me alone, you know, which we know is absolutely a lie because we infect anybody within 3 feet of us, you know. I mean, that's just the way alcoholism does. But when I got here, I was sort of alone because I had drank myself into a position where nobody cared whether I lived or died anyways, you know, other than you people in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I would bounce in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they used to call me the 90-day wonder. You know, every 90 days I'd wonder what I was doing in AA, you know. But I'm here to tell you that if you're new here or if you're old here and coming back again, whatever you've lost to get you to this program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you don't have to lose anything else. It can all be added to you as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous working in your life, and a God that you may not even know about, you know. But if you believe that I have one, and I believe that I have one, I'll lend you mine so you can find your own, you know. But the real reality is all you have to do in this program is to show up, sit down, shut up, listen, and do what they tell you to do, you know. And eventually, it will start to happen for you. When I bounced in out of AA one time, a guy met me at the door, and he said, kid, I didn't like that at all, you know. He said, you had better stay here this time. I said, why? He said, because this is where the magic is. And turned around and walked off. You know, and I'm sure I've had millions of people give me advice somewhere along the line, but I remember that old man telling me that I'd better stay here because this is where the magic is. And it's here. It's here in this room tonight. With over 1,300 people, it's here in this room tonight. Because if you're here and you're sober, or you're somewhat sane tonight, you've experienced some of the magic of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know. And I didn't understand what magic was all about, but he sort of explained it to me by walking off. And I sat there and I thought, well, I'll observe you people for a little while and see what this deal is really all about. And I stayed for a little while longer and stayed for a little while longer. And then, you know, but I wouldn't do things. I mean, I would not take a chip. We have desire chips in our part of the country, and I wouldn't take a chip, and I wouldn't sign a birthday card, you know. I wouldn't do the things you, because the things that you all were doing was for you all, you know, but not necessarily for me. And until I became willing to do the things that you all do, I couldn't stay sober. And somebody said, well, if you're having trouble with this program, you ought to check your drinking, you know. And I said, oh, well, that sort of makes sense, doesn't it? So I bounced in and out trying not to be a part of who you all are. I remember I had about 6 months. I don't mean six continuous months. I mean 6 months around you all, you know. And I decided I'd go to one of your business meetings. Had it on a Saturday. It was at the Preston Club in Dallas, Texas. And I sat in this business meeting and Y'all were talking about stuff. Now, I couldn't hear anything you're talking about because I was busy wanting to talk about my stuff. You know, that's the way alcoholics are. You always tell yourself if you're sitting in a discussion meeting and you can't ever hear anything because you're too busy running your head on what you're going to say, you know. And the bottom line is I was running my head on what I was going to say and they weren't calling on me, you know. And I finally went, and they didn't call on me. They just kept on with their business meeting. I went, and finally this old guy said, Maloney, what do you want? I said, it's a business meeting, isn't it? He said, yes, it's a business meeting. I said, well, I got some business I want to talk about. He said, well, what kind of business you want to talk about? And I said, who's in charge of your marketing program? They said, why do you ask? And I said, well, I tell you, I work in the apparel business now at the Apparel Mart, and I know a lot of people that could use this program that have lots of money. And you're going to have to spruce this place up and get some good brochures put together and clean this place up a little better. You're never going to get the right people in here, you know. Now, I also knew, I said, I have a degree in marketing, you know. And the guy said, yeah, baby thermometers have degrees too. You know what they do with them, you know. And y'all were not impressed with my intelligentsia. You really weren't? And I said, I'll tell you what, if you'll give me your marketing budget, I will get you the right drunks in there and we'll get this place squared away. And you know what y'all said? I think John's in charge of marketing. And he's in San Antonio this week. Why don't you just don't drink, read the book, and keep coming back, you know? And I spent a whole week walking around Alcoholics Anonymous and say, when do y'all think John's coming in? Y'all seen John? Yeah. That's what you did. Y'all humored people like me is what you did. Because this is a strange deal, and we don't get here understanding what this deal is all about. We really don't. It's very confusing for the new person. We laugh at all the wrong places. We do. We tell something real sad, and everybody goes, oh. We tell something real happy, and everybody cries, you know. We were sort of wired backwards, you know, and that's good. Good. You can't go into a meeting and sit down and say, oh, I had a bad day and I've been thinking about picking up my mother-in-law and have her run over the train and burning the house down this evening and the dog, I'm going to go get rid of that dog. I think I'm going to go out and shoot that dog. And everybody goes, ha, 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 just don't. You go to your average church group and tell them that. Or your average business meeting and tell them that. They'll lock you up is what they'll do. So I'm glad y'all are who you are, so I can be who I am. Because y'all have given me somebody that I can have with dignity and respect, and somebody I really don't mind hanging out with, you know. And that was my problem. You see, I was always alone. You know, I could be in a crowd of thousands and feel all alone. I was always alone. It's alone. I think probably alcoholism is one of the loneliest diseases there is known to man. And it's the only disease that is always, your mind is always telling you that you don't have a disease. Your mind, if you'll listen to your mind will always convince you without a shadow of a doubt that you're not suffering from this illness. So therefore we say, don't listen to your mind too much, you know, better call your sponsor, you know. My sponsor said that my mind was sort of like a bad neighborhood. I should never go on up there alone by myself. Yeah. Every once in a while I say, well, I can hear God from there. Mm. Call your sponsor immediately. You know? During one of those periods of time, I bounced in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous. My dad was one of my drinking buddies. And we drank a lot of whiskey together, you know, and we did that. And in fact, I'd reduced it down to he was the only one that would still drink with me, you know. And I was his excuse to get out of the house. And then I had to do penance for a while after that. We were down at the Apparel Mart in Dallas, Texas, and setting up for a show, and stopped over to one of the nicer places that I drank in called the Blue Note Lounge, you know. I drank in those places called Mom's Place, Blue Note Lounge, The Cave, I mean, you know, those highfalutin places, you know. And Dad and I had been in there drinking for a while, and we were drinking They weren't Rob Roy's. They were shots of beer and mugs of, mugs of beer and shots of whiskey is what it was. And we would take the shots and we'd drop them in the big fishbowl of beer, and we call them depth charges. And we'd boo. And the job is to drink all that down and not put your eye out with a shot glass, you know. And and we were drunk by then. We'd been there fine. We were pretty drunk. And he said, "I got to go home. We got to go." And I said, "I can't leave now." And he said, "Why not?" And I said, "I'm in love." Now, it didn't take me but about three drinks to fall in love, you know. He said, "You're in love?" I said, "I'm in love with that lady I've been dancing with and talking to." And he said, "Look at her. Just look at her." And I looked over, and she was had her head down on the bar. This is about 6 o'clock in the afternoon. And it was back in the days when all the women were wearing wigs. And her wig had come off and was laying up on the bar. He said, "She ain't got no hair." Little detail like that never did bother me, you know. He said, "We gotta go." I said, "All right, all right." We got outside and he says, "You are too drunk to drive." I couldn't even walk. I said, "Yep." He said, "I'll follow you home in my car to make sure you get there okay." And that seemed like a real logical deal. I don't know if I was going off in the ditch, but he just went off in the ditch with me or what. I was driving a big Lincoln Continental about 100 foot long and had big yellow doors on it and had whiskey bumps all over it, you know how it is. Finance company was looking for it and had to park at different places at night. Got to keep the image up. And I said, "I'm hungry." He said, "Hungry?" He said, "You're drunk. Let's go home." And I said, "I'm hungry." And right across the street was this chicken place, you know. I said, "Let me go over and get some chicken and I'll get it to go." And he said, "I'm not going to wait long." And I said, "All right." So he pulled over to me to the chicken place, and I went up to the chicken place, and it was a Church's fried chicken. I don't know if y'all got them in this part of the country, but I went up to Church's, and it was not a real good neighborhood to begin with, you know. And they didn't have any go inside because that's where they held everybody up inside, you know. And so down on Maple Avenue in Dallas, and I went up to the window. They have one of them little windows with a little tray sticking out of it, you know, where you order through the window, you know. And I went up to the window, and lady came to the window, and she looked at me with those disgusting eyes. You know, the ones the family members always looked at you with, and your kids and your wives, and just stare holes in you. And she said, "What do you want? What do you want?" You know, she evidently could tell I'd been drinking just a little bit, you know. And I had grabbed a hold of that tray, that little windowsill, and when you grab a hold of something and you've been moving this fast, you know, and all of a sudden that whole building was rotating. I'm trying to hold the building down on the ground. And I thought that was a dumb question. You know, I'm at a chicken place. She wants to know what I want. I said, "I want some chicken." She said, "How much chicken do you want?" I said, "How much chicken have you got?" We were in a power play by then. She said, "I got more chicken than you'll buy." I said, "You bet me, you know. I want the family bucket of chicken." And she said, "You want mashed potatoes?" I said, "You bet your gravy, you know." I bought corn. I bought peppers. I don't even like peppers. I said, "You bet you I'll take some of them peppers. Put them in there." And I paid out and got in the car and had to set my picnic up. You know how we get, you know. Make a cup of drinks, set all your picnic table up, get the buckets out, get the potatoes out, you know. And my dad's still sitting in his car saying, "Come on, come on." Nobody said this is going to be a serious talk. Well, I'm driving down the road eating my chicken and, you know, and just having best time. Alcoholics, we could live in our cars forever. We could. Yeah. Just wasn't so hot in Texas, you know, we could have been there forever. I'm eating that chicken and drinking that whiskey and slopping in them potatoes and, you know, and chewing a little corn, and I look up in front of me, and my dad's behind me, and my God, it was the biggest wreck I've ever seen in my life. And there must have been 8 or 10 18-wheel trucks, and they just seemed like they was all piled up together. And I thought, oh, my God, I'm going to jail again, you know. Because, you know, I know there'll be flares and there'll be cops, and they could pull me up in that again and see me with all that chicken all over me, and, you know. At least I'm not going hungry, by God. And I thought, oh, Lord, I shouldn't have done this deal. I made a bad deal. And the closer I got to the wreck, it became really, I had a moment of clarity, and I looked up, and it wasn't a wreck after all. It was the Dallas North Tollway, and it had all them red and green lights, you know. My dad's behind me honking the horn going like that. I pulled up to the toll gate, and I thought, well, I'm not going to dig in my pants and get my pants all greasy with this chicken all over me. So I just threw in $3 or $4 worth of chicken, you know. I was picking out the necks and the wings, and I threw them in that basket, and right on through. My dad didn't call me for 2 weeks. He got off at the first exit. Like he didn't know me. I called him a couple weeks ago. I said, you know, I could have died out there that night. He said, yep. We were speaking in a... No, I wasn't speaking. I was carrying my wife's bag. She was the Al-Anon speaker at the Palm Springs Roundup one time and years ago. And we were sitting there, and I was sitting on the front row. That's where my sponsor sentenced me for the rest of my life, you know. He said, people like you need to be right up on the front, dummy. I said, okay. So I'd sit on the front row, and this guy was sitting next to me, and my wife was up there talking, you know, and he wanted to talk to me. And he was carrying on a conversation. I went, he said, where are you from? I said, Texas. I'm from Arkansas. Who cares? I mean, I didn't care. I'm trying to not be rude to my wife. She's up there talking. He says, you been to Arkansas? I said, yeah, I've been there a couple times. Oh, how long you been sober? I said, a while. He said, you ever hear a guy in Texas called the Chicken Man? I said, nope. I've been wanting to be known for a lot of things, but that ain't one of them. They've been known to bring me buckets of chicken up here when I talk before. You know, it's embarrassing. How's the chicken man, you know? The great orator. When we arrived here, we checked in the hotel, and I said, call down there and see if they have a fitness center, because I'm trying to get fit, you know. And doctor's been telling me that I need to do that, and I said, see if they got a masseuse, and they didn't. And so today, we were going to go out to the fairgrounds, to the antique thing. They got a little antique flea market going out there, and my wife went out there, and you know, she loves antiques and likes to shop. That girl likes to shop. She likes shop, and I like to pay. I mean, that's part of the deal, you know. If you're having a problem with that guy, just get over it, you know. Because one of the questions you never ask is that new, you know? She says if it spends the night in her closet, it's not new. Yeah. Works for us. And as we were shopping out there today, a young man, Scott, took us out there. I said, Scott, what do you do for a living? He said, I'm a masseuse. I said, oh, today's your lucky day. We're going to call you into service right after we get through at this flea market. Thank you, Scott, for the massage. Well, it was nice. But while we were there, you know what she saw out there that she loved more than anything else? Was a puppy dog. Little bitty puppy dog. They got little animals out there, and they sort of remind us of the new people in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, their nose are still wet, and you know, got them eyes, and they're so cute. Y'all are so cute when you first get here, you know. We thank God if they live, we're going to be just like us someday, you know. And she's holding this little puppy dog, And I got a little puppy at home and I bonded with, you know. And in fact, I heard a guy in a meeting the other day, he said that his goal in AA was to become half of the person that his dog already thought he was. That ain't no bad deal. That ain't no bad deal. I said, we're not buying that dog. I said, we're on an airplane. She said, oh, honey, it's so cute. So I don't know if we're going home with the dog yet or not, you know, and who knows. But I will tell you that that dog, not that dog, but a dog, when I went to Bob White one time when I was between marriages, and I don't like going to sponsors. I don't know about you all, because they tell you stuff you don't want to hear and have you do things you don't want to do. And I went in and I was between marriages. In fact, in my fourth year of sobriety, I went broke and was bankrupt and was divorced again. Divorced in sobriety. That was rare. I'd always been divorced drunk before, and I was divorced in sobriety. Oh, what's her name? Divorced me in sobriety, you know. And she said things like, I love you, but I can't live with you anymore. Yeah. And we don't understand that as alcoholics. We understand beat us, kill us, knock us down, tell us you hate us, but don't tell us you love us and then throw us out. We don't know about that. I had to learn later on what that meant in my life, but it was in that particular deal I went finally after. I was sentenced to not speak in Alcoholics Anonymous for 1 year. Give my name and sobriety date and not date. And don't call her. That was my sentence for 1 year. Ran concurrently, by the way, you know. And I don't know how Bob White knew it, but one day I snuck off down to Waco from Lake Whitney to a noon meeting. And they called on me, and I shared for 20 minutes. And I had to report back to his house at 5:30 every day. I had to go at 7:30 in the morning and get my assignment for the day. And at 5:30, I had to come back. And he taught me about a book called The Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You see it on both sides of the table. A great book. Story in there about Jerry and me. Yep, good book. And we studied that textbook because it says this is the text we use, which means it's not supposed to be read at all. It's supposed to be studied. And we studied that textbook. And we went back through the steps. And I had books that were by great speakers and had people signing them and stuff. He said, throw all them away. They don't work for you. He said, you're absolutely crazy. You're divorced. You're bankrupt. Everything's not going well in your world. He said, life does not work on your terms, and you're going to have to learn that. And he was right. Life in sobriety is never designed to work on my terms. It's only designed to work on your and God's terms. And when I can operate within the parameter of you and God, my life goes real good. It's only when I get outside of that parameter into my own way of doing it that I seem to be in trouble. So I had to surrender to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous again at a depth. And that was May the 20th of 1980. That was my emotional sobriety date. And I've got it in that big book, and I've got that big book somewhere where we've highlighted it, and we've studied that textbook. And he said, wherever it says alcohol or alcoholism, I want you to cross through it and put your initials up there and put SC. And I said, what's that for? And he says, self-centeredness. He said, that's your primary illness. It ain't alcohol. You just thought it was alcohol and drugs. He said, that's what you did as a result of your illness. He said, it's sort of like measles. He said, how do you know if you have measles? And I said, well, you get red spots. He said, no, measles, the spots are merely a symptom of your disease. Measles is a virus that you have, and it's hidden under the skin in a place that you can't see. He said, and it shows up as red spots. That's why they call it measles. He said, alcoholism is sort of like that. You show up drunk and in jail and do things you shouldn't do. But that's just the nature of the illness. He said, the real illness you have is self-centeredness. And he says, it goes in the book and it talks in great depth about how you need to conquer your self-centeredness. Because we think that our problems center in our own mind. We think that our troubles are of our own making. I mean, those are not stuff you want to hear. Alcoholics Anonymous. And I treat it with the 12 steps, and I treat it with God. And I treated, but it was at that one time I went to Bob and I said, Bob, I said, this stuff is all right, but I'm so lonely. I'm just so lonely. He said, go buy a dog. I said, what? I had a blonde in mind. He said, go buy a dog. Get an inside dog. One you got to go home, let out. One you got to feed. One has. He said, you don't know nothing about loving anybody other than yourself. He said, I'm so sick of you. I thought, my God, I'm failing AA. But I owe that man my life because he's the one that put me back together. And that's the legacy that we have in Alcoholics Anonymous, is we owe it to those people that have gone before us and have told us those insane things to do that seem to have worked in our lives. And that's the legacy of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my responsibility is to pass that responsibility and that legacy on to the next person. So you may pass it on to the next person. And you may pass it on to the next person. Because without us passing it back and forth and on to the next person, we have no legacy to leave. So I'm grateful for the Dave C's and the Kenny S's and the Tom, where's old Tom at, you know, and Tom and all you folks and you 30-year plus guys that have been there forever and ever, because by God, without you, we wouldn't know where we were going. And I think you deserve a hand. I really do. Let me tell you what else I'm grateful for. I'm grateful to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I really am. Now, we talked about the old timer and how grateful we are, but we also have to be grateful for the new person in Alcoholics Anonymous. Because without the new person, the old timers wouldn't have anybody to talk to except each other. And I know that we'd get tired of talking to each other after a while. We'd become so dry we'd be a fire hazard probably, you know. We always have to have the newcomer in our life. You know, and I walked into this meeting tonight, and a young man came up to me, and his name's Daryl. Daryl, stand up for a minute and sit down, quick. Okay, sit down. 6 weeks ago or 8 weeks ago or whenever it was, Daryl was in my truck in Lake Whitney, Texas. And Daryl had been sober about 4 or 5 hours then, you know, a few days. And Daryl was down and out and had nowhere to go. And Daryl came out of Georgia originally, and he somehow ended up in Lake Whitney, which is where he was raised at. And we were in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and we put him in the truck, and we started talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And Daryl said that magic answer the newcomer always says, "Can you lend me $20? And I said, "What do you need it for?" He said, "Food." I said, "All right." So I took him to the grocery store. They don't like going right to the grocery store. I said, "I don't buy beer, I don't buy cigarettes. Go in there and get what you need to eat and bring me a receipt. I'll wait here for you." He come out and he gave me some change back, about $7. And I said, "Daryl, you sure you're an alcoholic?" He said, "Well, yeah, I think so." I said, "Well," I said, "if I'd have went there with $20, I'd have spent $19.99, you know." But when I walked into a meeting tonight, Daryl came up and hugged my neck. He said, "I couldn't believe it's you." He said, "I said, I can't believe it's you. Where have you been?" He said, "I ran away. I'm in Georgia again, you know." So now you've seen Daryl. It's everybody's task in the whole Southeast is to make sure that old boy stays sober one day at a time. He's got a chance. He's got a chance. He's got a chance of staying sober one day at a time, because God brought him here tonight to see you people. Now he has 1,300 and some odd friends tonight that he didn't have to have. And if he hadn't have met me 8 weeks ago, you might not have known Daryl, except Ben's got him pretty good hands over there. But I'm proud of you for being here. I really am. And I hope you can find in Alcoholics Anonymous what I've been able to find in Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's a life that I couldn't believe. A life that I couldn't believe. Yep. That's how Alcoholics Anonymous works. My bride and I spend a lot of time traveling around the country lately, and we enjoy doing that. We really do. So we may pull up. We just went out and bought a motor coach, and so I'm going to try retirement one day at a time. It's going to kill me in about a week, I imagine, but, you know, but we're going to ride around the country and do some AA and some fellowshipping and go see some of the people we don't normally get to see and do some of the things that we want to do. And we couldn't have done that without you people. We just couldn't have done that without you people. I've been observing lately in Alcoholics Anonymous that some of my peer group, which is got anywhere sober from 70 to about 78, we sort of got a gang we all hang out with, and there's about 12 couples of us. And I've watched their kids now grow up, and some of the pain that they're going through, I feel that I'm hurting for them, because we hurt for each other. I don't know about you all, but when we hurt together. That's how we recover. We recover together, and we hurt together. And I think that's how we're supposed to grow together. And I watched my current sponsor, Jerry, who was my first sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous. go through a place in sobriety where he wasn't doing it the way his kids wanted him to do it. And he was close to those kids all his life. And all of a sudden they're grown and got their own families, and they don't feel that he spends enough time with them because he spends too much time with us. And I've watched that. And I think that's sad. And I've got another friend of mine, Doug and Barbara, and their daughter hadn't talked to them in 6 years now because she went to counseling and said that she probably ought to not talk to her parents for a while. And it's been 6 years, and it's been hard because I hurt with those people. And I've got two kids of my own, and Karen has a boy of her own that's like my son too. And two of those kids are sort of messed up right now, and they're mine, you know. Hers is great, you know. And we get along well with hers, and we can relate, and we bond, and we do all that. And mine, I don't have a clue who they are or what they're doing because we just don't know how to talk to each other. And I've watched myself go through that with the pain in my own family. And they sort of implied that they would like me to spend more time with them instead of you people. And you see, I can't do that. And I can't do that because for whatever reason God gave me sobriety, He gave me sobriety to be with you people. He didn't give me sobriety so I can get well to go with those people, whoever those people are. And that's hard when it even gets to be your own children, when they don't understand, when they get to be grown adults. Now, I know that they're going through their own deal, some of them in active alcoholism and some of them of just sobriety, but dry, but not going to meetings. And I've watched both of my kids go through their struggles, and I hurt for those children. But under no circumstance can I leave you people to go to those people, because you are my people. It says there was a book out called Illusions one time, and a guy named Bach wrote it, and he said, those of true family are not necessarily of those of blood. And I believe I found my family in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I hope and pray that someday that son of my sponsor, Jerry, will one day wake up and say, God, Dad, I'm so proud of you and those people and the people you work with. And I'm hoping that that daughter of my friend's who's been with them for 6 or 7 years without talking to them one day picks up the phone and gets hit dumb with something and calls her parents and said, God, I love you. Because we don't have a lot of time. I don't know about you, but I had no idea I was going to stay sober this long. I'd have given me up for dead long time ago. And it seems like the longer I stay sober, the less I know about sobriety. But the more I know about how important it is for me to have that relationship with you people. I've been blessed with a great marriage and been blessed with a lot of friends and a lot of you people in my lives. And God, I love y'all. I really do love you. And I love being a part of you. And what the big book says for me and says for you is what God wants for people like me and for people like you is to walk hand in hand in the fellowship of the Spirit and the sunlight of the Spirit. And it also says in there that what He wants for us is to be happy, joyous, and free. And if we're not happy, joyous, and free, it is not because of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or the Al-Anon family group. It is because we are not applying ourselves as it directs us to do so. So God can then intervene in our lives and change our lives. Now, I've loved you people for a long time. And I thought, well, y'all probably thought I was okay. But I never knew how much y'all really loved me. About a year and a half ago, I was on the way to the movie in Waco, Texas, and with my bride. And we were stopped at Kmart. Don't ever go to Kmart. And they were having a blue light special. And I decided I'd have a heart attack instead. And I stand there with my basket full, and I got sweaty all over and got clammy and I got nauseous, and I thought, oh my God, I'm going to die in Kmart, you know. Aisle 17, there's a cleanup, you know. Put a big sign on me, no hable inglesa. Karen said, "What is wrong with you?" I said, "I don't know." I said, "I just, God, I feel weird. I just feel really weird." And she said, "Well, give me the cart. You go on out to the car." I said, "Okay." So she came out to the car and she said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "No, I don't think so." I said, "But I'll be all right once we go to the movie. You know how we are." Yeah. She said, "Well, we got enough time. Let's run on by the doctor's office and just get you checked out." Well, one thing led to another, and they put me in the hospital and decided they'd run an EKG on me and do that sort of thing. And it doesn't take us long to get acquainted with people, you know. So all of a sudden, I knew all the nurses and knew the doctors, and I'm having a good old time visiting. And they took me in, and the doctor said, "Well, before I let you go home," he said, "I want to put you on this thing called a stress test on this machine, and we're going to let you run a little bit and see how your heart does." I said, "It'll be just fine." He said, "You tell me if you have any pain." And I ran. He said, "You got any pain?" I said, "No." He said, "You got any pain?" I said, "No." He said, "You got any pain?" I said, "No." And then he ran me 9 or 10 minutes, and then he said, "Well, you flunked the test." And I said, "What do you mean I flunked the test? I didn't have no pain." He said, "Yeah, but your waves on your EKG were below a certain level, and you've got some blockage, and we're going to have to do a heart cath on you." And I said, and that didn't sound like anything I wanted to do, you know. And the other problem was I was feeling good. I mean, by that time, I wasn't having no pain. I'm ready to go to the movie, you know. He said, "No, I don't believe we'll do that today. We're going to hold you in here tonight and take a look at you tomorrow, and we'll run a heart cath." I said, "All right." So we rolled out in the hall, and the nurse had me in a wheelchair, and we rolled out in the hall. My wife was in there talking to the doctor, and I looked up at this nurse, and I said, "Let me ask you a question." She said, "Sure." I said, "What happens when you lose somebody?" And she said, "What?" I said, "When you lose somebody, what happens?" She said, "What do you mean when I lose somebody?" I said, "Well, if somebody died on you, what would you do?" And she said, "Well, I don't know. Why?" And I said, "Well, I'm fixed to die." I said, "I just have a funny feeling that I'm leaving." And I said, "Whatever you need to do, go ahead and do it right now, because I'm getting ready to go, you know." And she said, "Oh, you're kidding me." And with that, my heart quit, and I dropped and fell dead out of the chair. And the strange part about that deal is then they came up and got me started and brought the crash crew up and got me going again. Now, the problem I had was not me living through the deal. And I did have a good spiritual experience during all that, so I'm not worried about dying. I'm in no hurry. I like it here. I'm sure it's not bad over there. It didn't seem bad, but I'm going to stay with you people. You my people. Don't let me go, you know. So what I experienced as a quadruple bypass surgery to get all that stuff unplugged, but what I experienced more than that is I experienced the love of you people like I've never experienced it before in my life. See, I know how to love you. I've been doing that now for 24 years, and I know how to love you people at a depth that I didn't know I was capable of doing, was loving you the way I love you. And I really do love you. But you see, I didn't know how to have you love me. And that was the hardest thing that I've ever had to do in sobriety, is to let all of you love me when I couldn't love myself. And it was during that period of time, during that surgery and during that recovery period and the convalescent period, that my God and I were just like this every minute. And you people got into my heart. And you got into my heart because it was, I call it my grand opening, because it was open. And somehow or another, God had to let that thing open up so you could jump in there. But what it did is it made me love you people in a way that I've never known, because for the first time in my life, I felt total love and total oneness with you people. With you people. And I don't ever want to lose that again. So what we have to do to ensure that is to remember the legacy of those that have gone on before us and are still here. We need to remember the Darrells and the people that have been here for a long time. We need to be regular attenders at your local club, making meetings on a regular basis and working with drunks that still suffer. We need to have God be the central figure in our life. And if you could do that, countless things will happen to you. Miracles will happen to you. And can happen for you like they've happened for me. So if I brought any message tonight at all, it's merely that I love you. I really do. And I hope that you love me. When that man said to me, when I first walked into Alcoholics Anonymous, he said, "Kid, you'd better stay here, because this is where the magic is.
please, please don't leave until the magic can happen for you. I love you. Thank you for letting me talk.